You're finally getting down and understanding and having ways to look at inflammation within the body better, depending on the disease. So I think it's something that we've suspected in many conditions, like migraine, for instance, for a long time, seeing elevated markers in the blood of inflammation, but not really being able to visualize it per se. I think that there's probably, and some inflammation is really severe, but other inflammation is just very insidious, low grade, but still important.
According to the prestigious medical journal Nature, systemic and chronic inflammation has been recognized as the most significant cause of disease today. It plays a role in cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, kidney disease, liver disease, and autoimmune and neurodegenerative disorders. Migraine is no exception, and most of us with chronic migraine also have one or more other chronic health conditions. Is inflammation the missing link? To help us understand inflammation's role in migraine, and most importantly, how we can manage it, is Dr. Gretchen Tijen. Dr. Tijen, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Inflammation is a broad term that gets mentioned frequently. What is it really?
Well, it's a complex set of cellular reactions and protein signaling within the body that, in the acute phase, helps us fend off infection, and it, or if it's from trauma, helps us, heal injuries. And but it can be either acute, which is actually a good thing for the body, or it can become chronic. And when it's chronic inflammation, that's when all those diseases you just mentioned come into play. That's where the problem arises. But it is a complex set of interactions that are there for the body. And you mentioned autoimmune in that long list. When the body sends, or when the immune system sends out signals that we are supposed to continue to fight infection or wounds that are no longer there, that can turn into sort of an autoimmune response where we're fighting something that's not even present, and that can cause chronic inflammation as part of it.
Is there such a thing as good inflammation? Like, does it serve a purpose?
Yeah, I would say I would equate good inflammation with acute inflammation. If you have something, and typically the things that we'd be talking about that we'd notice as inflammation would be things we could see. So let's say it was something on the body, in a joint or on the skin, and you see redness and you have pain and you have some swelling and it's warm, or it hurts to use a joint, that might be what happens in acute inflammation. But if in a few days it goes away and gets better, then we would consider that good inflammation. The body did what it was supposed to through the inflammatory response and all that goes with that to heal itself. But inside the body, when we're talking about chronic inflammation, a lot of times it's things you can't just look at, see, and monitor visually. It's more like some of the sick behaviors, and that would be if you just felt fatigued or maybe sort of depressed, or you didn't want to eat, or you just weren't feeling, feeling out of sorts, feeling a little depressed, feeling like nothing sort of was right, couldn't sleep well. Those all might be signs potentially of chronic inflammation.
Okay, so there's two main types of inflammation: acute inflammation and chronic inflammation. And so you were just describing symptoms of chronic inflammation, such as fatigue and.
Right. Those would be things that would be probably what you'd have in a more chronic case of inflammation.
And acute inflammation is when you bump your knee and then you get a bruise and maybe there's a bit of
Yeah, or
redness.
it could be something within the body, when you're fighting off an infection there. But, and so there you're not going to be able to see it as well. Although, if you take an x-ray of your lungs, they might see some edema, or, some of the same things that happen on the outside on the skin are happening inside the body. We just don't see it. But, that is something that's usually you know, if need be, treated with antibiotics or whatever, they're usually, you know, bacterial things, then that might be something that we get over. But you don't necessarily have to have an infection to have sort of this chronic inflammation.
And I guess the one of the other defining characteristics is that acute inflammation is temporary. It kind of spikes in response to something like an infection or a bump,
exactly,
and then drops right off, whereas chronic sort of lingers, it remains.
Lingers. And it could be something that goes on for, you know, a lifelong, in a lifelong condition. But, you know, unfortunately, with a lot of diseases like cardiovascular disease, you may not know you have a problem until you have a heart attack. But, you know, some of the atherosclerosis and stuff that's been building up in the coronary arteries, you know, has probably been a process that's been going on for many years. And the higher the amount of inflammation in your body, probably, and, you know, that can be genetically determined plus by environmental stimuli. But that is something that you might not know until you hit a point where you obstruct your coronary artery and have chest pain, all those symptoms. So, you know, some inflammation, people might have those sick behaviors and just not feel well. But in other cases, it's doing something in the body, and you may not have as much of an inkling of it.
So it seems like inflammation has gotten a lot of attention lately. Is this focus on inflammation justified? Do you, like, is it all just a bit of hype, or is this genuinely something we should be aware of and conscious of?
No, I think that, I mean, they're finally getting down and understanding and having ways to look at inflammation within the body better depending on the disease. So I think it's something that we've suspected in many conditions, like migraine, for instance, for a long time. You know, seeing elevated markers in the blood of inflammation, but not really being able to visualize it per se. I think that there's probably, and you know, some inflammation is really severe, but other inflammation is just very insidious, low grade, but still important. You know, if you have a disease like inflammatory bowel disease that has a recurrent case, you know, that's ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, where you get, you know, sick and then you get better and you get sick and you get better and you get on immunosuppressants and you drugs and you improve for a while, you know, that's one trajectory of condition. But something like irritable bowel syndrome, you know, that's something where structurally, if a doctor goes in to look with a colonoscope, they may not actually see anything that looks that unusual, but yet you do have a condition of problems with gut dysmotility, with diarrhea, with constipation. You know, it can be quite a heavy burden on a person to have that condition, but it's more a low level of inflammation and harder to detect with blood tests, for instance, or, you know, there's really no easy biomarkers. And migraine's been kind of like that. You know, I've done some work in the biomarkers of inflammation and hypercoagulation and things that we see with endothelial dysfunction. But even though we see, if you compare the migraine group to the non-migraine group, you see elevations in migraine and something like C-reactive protein, which is one of the most common markers of inflammation, but yet it may not be that elevated, you know? And so it's one of those things where if you're comparing them and statistically you're seeing a difference, you're probably onto something. But on the other hand, it's not something where I could just draw a blood test. It's so nonspecific. It could be elevated, but it could be because, you know, I'm getting a sinus infection. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that can acutely increase that. And that's why, you know, having all these different studies that people have done, and if they tend to show the same things, it's very helpful, meaning there's something there, but it may not be an overwhelming reaction like you might see if the person had something like a vasculitis or cancer, or, you know, some kind of diseases might really increase the inflammation to a point where you know it's abnormal just by looking at the blood tests. The other one just might be a little out of range, or maybe at the upper limits of range, but not really that abnormal. And so there helpful when you're trying to study it and study the mechanisms. They may not be that helpful on a day-to-day basis when you're treating a patient in some conditions like irritable bowel and migraine. So they're not things that are typically done outside of studies.
So there's a lot in that response, which I want to make sure I can break down. And so
okay.
one of the first things you mentioned was the inflammatory marker, C-reactive protein, and that the level of C-reactive protein in someone who has chronic inflammation may only be subtly higher than an otherwise healthy subject. Are there other markers that you can use, or do you do multiple tests for C-reactive protein? Because, I mean, we've heard about how inflammation connects to some of the most, you know, devastating diseases that affect the population. If you're concerned about it, like, you know, is there a test that we can get?
Well, I mean, C-reactive protein and sedimentation rate, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, those are good tests because they're not that expensive and they're readily available. And if you find something elevated, you can monitor it. But it's just that those tests are so much more abnormal in some conditions, and they're so much easier to actually monitor. I will frequently, and I started doing this, started looking at it and then, you know, making comparisons and doing this part of, a structured approved study so that, you know, we were getting the information and actually using it in ways. But there are other markers of inflammation. Like when I did some of my studies, we did inflammatory cytokines. Those are interleukin beta, interleukin 6, I think interleukin 10. You know, there's a number of those. There's transforming growth factor beta. There's TNF alpha. You know, these are inflammatory cytokines that we've also looked at in disease or conditions like migraine, comparing them to healthy subjects without migraine and see that they are elevated. We know also that some of those are, and those cytokines in particular, are elevated during the attack. So that's really good information to have. If you see something that, you know what it is at baseline, then you get it in the middle of an attack and then you check it again when they've gotten back to baseline and you see where there's a rise, you know, that can be helpful in telling you that's probably something that happened during the condition. In migraine, with some of these inflammation markers, you will see them if you compare it to a control group, you would see that both the baseline migraine, or sort of the interictal state of migraine between headaches, will be higher than in the control group, but also during an actual migraine attack, which is even higher than in between attacks, that will be higher than in the control group. And if you look between people that are in an attack compared to out of an attack for them, if you looked at a group of people, you would see that that is elevated significantly during the attack in some of these. But, you know, these are tests that are done as part of studies to get a feeling for what's happening, but they're not things that we use on a regular basis. Now, part of that, where they actually did it during an attack, but they didn't just measure it in the venous blood. They got it in like the venous circulation in the jugular venous blood, you know, coming down directly from the brain, showing us what was happening in the brain at that time, where you're going to have higher levels of markers. That was very helpful in making us understand the connection to inflammation and neuroinflammation and some of these cytokines in migraine. And it was also some studies that were done that showed other inflammatory substances, most important of which was the calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP, which is now, it's been known about for probably 20 years or so, but, you know, that knowledge hasn't just stood still. When people realized that, they started trying to develop drugs where they could use that information, block it, and then see if that actually helps the migraine, either prevent it or treat an acute attack. And what we know now, just in the last few years, since these drugs have been on the market, and the clinical trials showed that they were effective, that we have things like monoclonal antibodies against calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP, which is an inflammatory neurotransmitter, that helps prevent migraine. And people get monthly shots or every 3-month shots, and that can be very helpful. But then they just more recently came out with the GPANS drugs, which are the small molecule calcitonin gene related peptide antagonists, in that if a person takes that acutely for an attack, it will help abate the attack very quickly. And they've just recently approved a couple of these drugs for daily use and prevention of migraine. So the same drug might be used both acutely and for prevention. But that was from knowledge of these studies of like looking at some of these factors of inflammation that they got from these, you know, blood tests.
So to recap some of what you just said, people with migraine seem to have higher levels of inflammation, both at baseline when we don't have an current attack, and also at elevated levels during an actual attack. And that may be due to something like CGRP, the calcitonin gene-related peptide, which is released during a migraine attack, which is known to be an inflammatory neuropeptide.
Yes, it might be related to that or to the inflammatory cytokines that also play a role during an attack. You know, what happens is CGRP is released from the terminals of the trigeminal nerve endings around the blood vessels in the dura, which in meninges, which surround the brain. And when those are released because of activation of the trigeminal ganglion, when those are released, they are inflammatory and they cause the blood vessel to dilate. They cause the wall to, or they cause some leaking of proteins. They cause mast cell activation, platelet activation, mast cell degranulation. And that creates what we might call a sterile inflammatory response because it's not an infection causing it. But then the trigeminal nerve can also, a different part of it, but it can also then detect that that's going on, that this inflammation is going on, and transmit that back to, I think it goes to the nucleus caudalis and then is relayed onto the thalamus and the cortex. There it's perceived as pain. So the trigeminal nerve both can be part of what activates the system in the first place, and it can also then relay what happened after the activation and the sterile inflammation occurred back to the brain so that it perceives pain. There's another thing that happened, you know, with inflammation. When people have aura, which about 30% of people with migraine do, it's been shown in animal studies that the cortical spreading depression that occurs, which is part of the aura, it's sort of an electrical activity of first activation followed by sort of a period of rest electrically in the brain, that when that occurs, there's a release of inflammatory cytokines and those can, you know, be found in the circulation at some points, but they can also, you know, these are happening in the brain parenchyma, this inflammation, but it can also potentially get into the meningeal circulation as well and cause some problems there. So, you know, there's a lot going on inflammation-wise, but it is thought by a lot of very prominent researchers in this area that when inflammation becomes chronic, that leads to chronic migraine. You know, that the more migraine you have, the more likely you are to have elevation of inflammatory markers and actually more inflammation going on in the body. And people that have aura may actually even have, we noticed in our study that, you know, it did seem that the inflammatory markers were higher in aura than they were in migraine without aura, but it occurred in both conditions.
And which comes first? Is it the inflammation that brings migraine, or is it the migraine that brings the inflammation or causes the inflammation, or do they feed off each other?
I think they feed off each other. One came first, obviously something had to start it. And, you know, we know that migraine is probably 50% of migraine is, you know, an inheritable condition, you know, that people who have first degree relatives are about twice as likely to have migraine without aura. And if the relative has migraine with aura, they're about four times as likely to have migraine, you know, with aura. That seems to have a little bit more heritability, although we haven't identified the genes as well in these big genome-wide association studies. But so part of it is you have a predisposition, or some people call it a liability. I read in one article, genetic liability, but you have, you know, you have a predisposition to getting migraine if you've inherited it from, you know, a parent. But there are other things in the environment, and, you know, those can be things that can cause a lot of conditions and inflammation, but things like stress, things like lack of sleep, things like poor diet, things like having, you know, some kind of an infection or something, you know, it may make you more likely, because, you know, you can think of migraine as there's a threshold for it. Anyone could probably, any person, even if you don't have an hereditary predisposition, could probably get enough, could get a migraine if you had enough things going for you. If it was a woman and you happened to be on your menstrual period, plus you had had too much to alcohol and that was a trigger for you, and you hadn't been getting any sleep and you had a lot of stress, you know, all these things might cause somebody to have a migraine. And, you know, so you could have your first migraine just because all those things were kind of working against you, where, you know, once you started getting a lot of migraines, you maybe will be more likely to get more migraines. You know, it's kind of migraine begets migraine. That's why we try to stop it or treat it well. It's because we think that, you know, the more you get, the more you're going to get, type thing. And, you know, one of the things that I don't think is probably hasn't been researched enough yet, at least in as it regards to migraine, is sort of this whole brain gut access, you know, where the enteric nervous system within the gut, you know, really plays a role in our health. And, you know, it connects to, through the vagus nerve, to the central nervous system. And, you know, part of the whole gut isn't just the gut wall and some of the things that the cells in the gut wall do, but we have a lot of bacteria and other, you know, microbiota, you know, microbes within our gut. And those are really thought to have maybe a very big role. And if the gut gets out of balance, the type of bacteria in it aren't the most favorable ones, you can get a lot more inflammation. And that sends messages to the brain. And that might make somebody who's predisposed to migraine be more likely to get migraines or more likely to have chronic inflammation. And so, you know, I think that's the thing. You know, there's ways to control that without taking anti-inflammatory drugs. That's probably not the thing that's going to help the microbiome, but it's like having a better diet is probably the best thing you can do, since the diet really changes the microbiome. But, you know, stress management, you know, can make a difference as well, getting a lot of sleep, those things. But we know that when the gut microbiome is out of balance, that, you know, people do have problems with sleep. They, you know, their stress may get worse. They may get more migraines. That kind of thing is thought to be likely what's happening.
I'd love to come back to the gut and the link with inflammation and implications for treatments. We have a few questions from our community that I'd love to share with you. So the first is from Ray, who's a viewer from our community. And she said that managing internal inflammation seems to be the treatment now for virtually all health conditions, including autoimmune, migraine, cardiac. What is known about the cause of high levels of internal inflammation, and what specific techniques can be used to fight this type of inflammation?
Well, I mean, some conditions, you know, we see the inflammation outright, like if somebody has arthritis in the gut, in the lung, you may not see it as much as we talked about atherosclerosis. You know, it's working in the vessels, but you may not be aware until you have a problem with that vessel, it clots off or whatever. So, you know, any of those things I'd consider, you know, pretty much internal. And those are things where the markers that we measure aren't actually the culprits for causing the inflammation. They're just a marker of the inflammation. We call it kind of an epiphenomenon, like C-reactive protein. You're not trying to get your, you're trying to get your C-reactive protein lower because that meant you somehow improved your inflammation. But it's not, unless it's due to something like an infection, it's not the kind of thing that you'd normally treat with antibiotics. But there are a lot of things that can, you know, that can help probably. And a lot of them are, you know, the type of things that I mentioned where you're basically trying to create a more homeostatic environment. You know, you eat meals regularly, you eat good, healthy food, you avoid foods that have an inflammatory likelihood. And those would be things like processed foods, red meats, some of these things that are high in the omega-6, like sunflower oil, saffron oil, you know, a number of different things, you know, along those lines, that if you can kind of cut back things in your diet and increase the non-inflammatory, like omega-3, that would be probably a lot more helpful. And those would be things like you find it in fruits and nuts and leafy green vegetables and onions and garlic and some of the spices that people have been, you know, so interested in. And olive oil is another one that is fairly known for that. So that, you know, if you have a diet that is higher in the threes, lower in the sixes, then you are likely to have, you know, less inflammation, less of a leaky gut, and, you know, all the problems that come, you know, that come from that. So that's one thing. But I think that, you know, you can't really underrate things like good sleep, having, you know, a decreased emotional stress and physical stress. You know, so people that have taken up things like and do it effectively, like meditation or yoga or Tai Chi or all these things that are kind of moving meditations, that they've done studies on inflammatory markers in people that, you know, start doing these things, and it does lower them. So we know that those things are good for you. So, you know, that's hard to do. So it's not as easy as just taking something. But, you know, I think diet is something that, you know, is definitely really, you know, something that we can all participate in and make a difference in our health. And also, you know, there's a thing about weight where what we know in migraine, and I don't know if this has sort of been settled yet, but it was sort of looked like in a bunch of studies, at least ones from a while ago, when people first started looking like at this, like it wasn't that everyone that was overweight had migraine. So it wasn't clear how much of a risk factor being overweight was for getting migraine. But if you took people that had migraine, those that were on the overweight end of the spectrum compared to those that were normal weight, they had a lot more chronic migraine and frequent migraine. And one of the thoughts was, well, adipose tissue has a lot of very inflammatory components to it, and it's releasing inflammatory factors into the, you know, the circulation. And so one way to decrease chronic inflammation would be, you know, to, you know, weight loss, not always an easy thing to do, but, you know, that is one thing that some of those studies suggested. And, you know, they were hard studies to do, but I do remember reading one where they did bariatric surgery on people that were, you know, very, very overweight. And they noticed that a lot of those people's migraines improved after the bariatric surgery. Now, whether that had anything to do with getting rid of adipose tissue from the weight loss due to bariatric surgery, I don't know. But it's, you know, it's interesting things to look at.
Okay, so we've got a couple more questions. We might go through these a little quicker. Okay. Joan has chronic migraine, which has progressed to the point where she's been told by a rheumatologist that her blood work indicated she has high levels of inflammation circulating in her body and neuropathic pain. Can uncontrolled migraine lead to this situation?
No, I don't think so. It's a little bit different than sort of the osteoarthritis that most of us end up with, where it's the aches and pains in the joints. And, you know, sometimes that can be due to too much wear and tear on the joints, you know, that come with age, but also that come with age and being overweight. So I don't think, you know, I guess I can't say the exact answer to that question, because I haven't really thought of it in terms of like, oh, if you have arthritis, that's going to cause you to have headache. But we do know that they're comorbid. So I think that a lot of the things that are comorbid, especially the painful conditions, and you can look at things like irritable bowel, which I had mentioned, fibromyalgia is another one, migraine, osteoarthritis is another one, endometriosis, which we know has an inflammatory component to it, that with all these low-level underlying inflammations, it may be that one kind of leads to another. But some of the studies, I just was reading one interestingly that was looking at genes in population of endometriosis and population of migraine, and they do something that they call Mendelian randomization. But it's a technique to tell you whether one caused the other. And it did not look like migraine was a cause of endometriosis or endometriosis was a cause of migraine, but it did look like they had a lot of genes that overlap between the two that were in inflammatory pathways. So it may be that she has migraine and she has arthritis, you know, for some environmental reasons, but also genetically, she may be predisposed to it because of her genes that are important in the pathways and maybe some of the things that she's doing in her life and her diet or, you know, lifestyle, whatever, is upregulating genes or downregulating genes. You know, we have the genome, which we're born with, but we also have the epigenome, which usually is sort of environmental factors kind of translating themselves into gene changes is either up or down. And so, you know, it may be a combination of things. So I wouldn't say they're totally separated from each other, but I wouldn't say like, oh, I got migraine, I better be careful, I'm going to have osteoarthritis.
So let's get into some of the treatments that you mentioned. And one of the things that came up was diet. Is there any science to support a specific anti-inflammatory diet to reduce inflammation?
Yes. And I think the study came out probably just earlier this year or last year. It was in the British Medical Journal, where they took, I believe it was about less than 200, but maybe 188 or something, people with migraine. And they had three arms to the study, where one group, they didn't change the diet particularly. They had the same level of omega-3 and omega-6 that they had before they started. And they were recording daily headache diaries. And they were also doing some blood tests to look for markers. They weren't of inflammation so much. They called them like anti-nociceptive markers, but some kind of a blood marker. And they also did a thing for sort of how disabled were you by your migraines. We call it the headache impact test. They used a score on that. But anyway, they had that was sort of the control group that didn't really alter their diet much. And then they had one group where they just told them to start eating more of those omega-3, you know, the anti-inflammatory foods. And those were the ones that I had mentioned, like fruits, nuts, olive oil, leafy vegetables, onions, garlic, that kind of thing. And then they had the third group, but not to change their omega-6 diet. Then they had the third group where they told them increase the omega-3s and decrease the omega-6s. And that's where we saw in those, that's where we saw the most improvement in the headaches frequency. That group had more change in the blood tests that they were looking for. And they had a decrease in the headaches more than the group that just increased the omega-3s but didn't deal with the omega-6. But that also had a significant decrease in the number of headaches compared to the group that didn't alter their diet at all. And, you know, we've long suspected that. I mean, people have been kind of in migraine, have been handing out diets that sort of did that, just knowing that it just makes sense. But I think that was really the first big randomized controlled trial that had demonstrated what we sort of thought we probably knew. So that's great to actually have data where you can say, no, it's not just anecdotal. It's really has been shown to be helpful.
So this is a pretty groundbreaking study
that shows
like finally out of a lot of studies that have been conducted in a randomized controlled trial. So a credible research study that there actually is a diet where you increase your omega-3s and you lower your omega-6s and you can improve your migraine condition.
Right. And even just increasing your omega-3s still helps some. So, you know, anything you can do to your diet like that seem to definitely make a difference.
So omega-3s, so are these things like deep cold water fatty fishes like salmon and sardines and krill and mackerel, et cetera?
Yes, those are what's in the omega-3s. And so that I think is, and you see omega-3 in some of these other things, so nuts and, you know, some of that type of thing and some of the fruits.
Dark leafy greens, walnuts.
Yes, and garlic, onions. I know there must be more. But those are the things that have, you know, been sort of the mainstay of that kind of a diet.
Okay, so we elevate our omega-3s. We try and eat as many foods as possible and flax seeds.
I think if anyone just looks up, and it's all over the internet, but if you looked up foods that cause inflammation, and they may not all fit into those omega-6s, but they're inflammatory things that cause leaky gut, you know, like a lot of red meat, a lot of processed meats, lard, sugary sodas, you know, all these processed carbohydrates. I mean, those are things that really do cause inflammation. I know myself that, you know, every time I've cut carbs out of my diet, even before I can lose a pound, I notice like my knees don't hurt anymore or my fingers don't hurt, you know, just from arthritis due to age. But, you know, I think that sometimes you can see some of those changes quite quickly, much more quickly than you're going to see a big change in your weight where you can say, oh, it's because I don't have as much inflammatory adipose tissue anymore. No, there's something in the diet that I think takes effect quite quickly. And I think so that always makes it a little bit easier to stick to these things when you notice you actually feel better after a week or two.
So just to close off on that, the subject of the omega-3s and 6s. So omega-3s increase, omega-6s decrease. To get your omega-6s down, it's reducing your processed food. So anything like French fries, sugary sauces, sugary drinks, like you're basically getting rid of a lot of the foods that
junk foods.
That you can't pick off a tree or find on the ground, that kind of
thing. Right, right. I mean, I remember reading a book by someone that boiled down to his whole message, you know, for a more healthy diet was eat food. And that would be things your grandparents recognized as food. So not processed foods, you know, not too much, and mostly fruits and vegetables. And, you know, and I've always remembered that and thought like, that probably makes sense. Cause if you boil everything that's good in a diet down to it, that's probably what, you know, it mostly is. And I just think that, you know, even people when they say, well, you know, I can't go vegan or something like that, particularly if you eat a lot of meat and red meat, you know, reducing that as much as you can probably almost in itself would make a difference. You know, there's a lot of plant-based meats out there now that, you know, I think a lot of people have not tried yet. But, you know, it'd be interesting once they've become more popular to see if, you know, people notice anything, if there's really improvements, or when they study it, are there improvements in gut health and microbiome and stuff when people turn more to a little bit more to a plant-based diet.
So the food that gets fed to the meat you're eating is also important. So
yes, like corn.
Right. So if you're eating chicken that's raised on corn, then that's going to affect the quality of the chicken you're eating and therefore yourself. So if you're getting plant-based free-range chicken or beef, so cattle that's been fed instead of, you know, the corn that they might be given, that they're able to feed on grass, like their grass-fed beef.
Yeah.
It'll cost a little bit more, but it may also have a better impact for you physically.
It might. And I think it's hard to say because, you know, there's so many things that go into the equation. So, But I think that just, you know, trying to take things one by one and eliminate them. You know, some people have done, you know, testing also, like IgG testing on foods, because it's thought that food intolerance, that, you know, you may not even know right away that you have it when you eat the food. So it's not like you eat it and then you feel sick. It might not come for, you know, a day or two later. And so you don't realize it. That some people have gotten tested for those, you know, in some clinics, particularly that take a holistic approach and have sort of set this up. But that, you know, that by eliminating those foods, there are some scientific studies that have shown that maybe that can help with migraine as well. So.
Do you think that diet's the best way to treat inflammation in the body?
Well, I think it goes back to the whole heart of the matter. I think you can improve your gut health, that I think in turn can help you improve your brain health. And I think that taking things like supplements, you know, can be very helpful. We don't have some supplements, there's quite a bit of data on, other ones, not so much. But a lot of times people can get what they need, you know, in a more healthful diet and without actually going to, you know, to supplements. So yeah, I think it probably makes so much more difference than we realize. So, but I think getting a lot of, you know, I don't think you can underestimate how important it is to get enough sleep and get the right kind of sleep, but they all kind of tie into each other. Because if you have, if you're not healthy, you just may find getting, you know, getting to sleep more difficult, and or getting restful sleep. And, you know, it's, I think it becomes a vicious cycle sometimes. And I know a lot of women, particularly women in the age group where they're coming in because their migraines are worsening, like 40 to 50 years old, they're just have terrible sleep. Sometimes they have bad sleep habits, but sometimes they get into those sleep habits because they've just had a lot of trouble with sleep. And it's just interesting. You know, I have not really in the past approached it before of like, well, what's your diet? You know, that type of thing, and changing that. But it really may be that some studies have shown that what's microbiome does control sleep to some extent. Maybe that was really at the heart of it. You know, I've been reading a lot about it lately and wish I had known it more. Of course, some of the things that I'm reading are brand new, so I couldn't have known it before. But I do think that, you know, sleep, keeping regular hours, you know, all these circadian rhythm type things, you know, really paying attention to those, to your body, what it's trying to tell you, probably makes a difference. And I think stress management is a huge thing. You know, I had done some of my work in early life stress, which can sort of set up the body for having increased responses or abnormal responses to stress as adults, even if they've psychologically processed what happened to them, you know, when they were younger and all the adversity they had. It's sort of like it changes sort of how you process things sort of the rest of your life somewhat physiologically. And being able to really take control and learn stress management techniques so that stresses of everyday life don't sort of cause a lot of imbalance in your system, which might lead to more inflammation, I think is important as well. So that's sometimes things that people ignore, but that's where I think meditation has become so, or yoga, you know, those things have really become popular on their own, not with necessarily doctors telling people to do them, because I think people realize they feel better, and that may be part of why.
I think inflammation provides a couple of clues as to why migraine can be so complicated and so difficult, particularly chronic migraine, to break, because migraine itself can cause inflammation. Migraine is known to have is known to be comorbid with other sleep disorders and mood disorders, and there's medications for migraine that cause you to gain weight. All of these things just fuel off each other to cause more and more inflammation, and so it can build up to create like this, you know, rolling snowball that can be incredibly hard to stop.
Yes, and I think particularly when, you know, you have depression and anxiety thrown into that, which I think are, you know, certainly comorbid with migraine. But, you know, they've been tied to a lot of the things that have been tied to migraine, you know, their reactions to stress, both in, you know, youth and adulthood, that, you know, interfere with sleep. And, you know, we know there's a lot of inflammation depression. And it's thought that actually inflammation might cause depression, as well as depression causing more inflammation. And so it is kind of that thing. It can be a vicious cycle, and, you know, sort of which came first, that type of thing. But I don't know. I think that it's really important to recognize the interactions of all these different conditions with each other and sort of attack it at least it's something that may potentially be tying them together. And if I were to look at that, I'd say, you know, inflammation, stress, and just sort of lifestyle in general, including, you know, diet, exercise. We didn't mention exercise, but things like aerobic exercise, you know, are thought to be good for, you know, for inflammation. And so, you know, just taking control where you can take control.
I don't want to come back to exercise, actually. But just before we do you think it's fair to say that sleep is anti-inflammatory?
We know that sleep really helps with migraine. And it's thought because it sort of turns off different parts of the brain when you're asleep, so you're not still getting those signals. And I don't know how you'd study whether sleep was an anti-inflammatory, since, you know, I mean, you'd have to have some marker you were following that would respond that quickly, because we all need sleep. So I'm sure somebody's done it. I'm not a sleep specialist, so I don't really actually know that literature. But I am sure that probably people that go from getting very poor sleep, maybe because they have sleep apnea, maybe because they have insomnia, maybe because they have some other sleep disorder, to getting really good restful sleep, probably if you compared those two groups, they would see that they had differences in inflammation. Which came first, I don't know, because I think that getting good sleep can definitely decrease your inflammatory levels, but having inflammation can worsen your sleep very acutely.
Okay, and now coming back to exercise.
Yeah.
So exercise we know is great for migraine if you're able to do it, and particularly aerobic exercise that's low impact. But exercise, I thought, was also inflammatory in some respects. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think it can be inflammatory if you do exercise that and I'm certainly not an exercise expert, but I mean, if you do things that could hurt your joints or that type of thing, you know, you might have inflammation of that afterwards. You know, we know from doing certain exercises, if you had a job on the house and you had to do a lot of hammering, sawing, or something where you're lifting up and then you get a sore back, that kind of thing. You know, so definitely you can get inflammation from sort of wear and tear. But if a person is, you know, conditioned or slowly conditions themselves so that they're not actually causing injury to their body, but doing things like aerobic. I mean, I personally find, being somebody with arthritis, that bike riding is, you know, great exercise if you do it and you do it as best you can, go as far as you can, as fast as you can, with as much resistance as you can take. And I think it's very good exercise. Or people that use stationary bikes and do high intensity training and that kind of thing, where you exercise real fast for a minute or two and then, you know, rest for a minute and then do it again and again. So, you know, we know that those things, because they get up your metabolism, and that, I think that does decrease your inflammation, that type of thing. So I think it just sort of depends on how you get into it. That's why if you're somebody that hasn't been exercising, discussing it with somebody like a physical therapist, a trainer, you know, somebody that does that for a living, a sports physician or somebody that knows a lot about it. You know, your doctor may or may not know so much about it, depending on what they do. They may spend most of their time sitting in a chair in an office trying to take care of you, but not that much exercise. So I think that, you know, but really getting into it the right way will make a difference and makes it easier and more, you know, enjoyable and safer. So
anti-inflammatory treatments are really commonly used. NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, are one example, such as ibuprofen, and there's many others. Do these work to address inflammation in the body, and would, you know, daily use of these be recommended?
Well, you know, people that have arthritis use them daily. And I think that they see benefit. With migraine, I'm not sure that we've been able to do that. We do have done things like what I call mini prophylaxis. If a person has menstrual migraine, you know, now there's some treatments that have been done with the triptans, for instance, you know, which are not anti-inflammatory drugs, but people would use those starting a few days before the headache's going to start and then going for 4 or 5, 6 days and then stopping and maybe not get that menstrual migraine. But 30 years ago, when I started practicing, 35 years ago, you know, we were using things like naproxen sodium, and we tell people take this twice a day, you know, for about a week around your menstrual period and see if it helps. And it would help. I think the problem with doing that long-term, if you don't need to, is that there's a risk. There's a certain percentage of the population, it's not a real small percentage, that is going to get some, you know, reaction from their kidneys. And I think that that makes it where if we can find safer drugs than that, that's probably better. So I don't really know that it would help someone that much, you know, with migraine to totally keep it away. We don't normally recommend it.
And then I guess there's a risk as well of medication overuse over time in some people.
Yeah. And how much some of those would cause it is hard, but, you know, there have been things that have shown that even non-steroidals, even acetaminophen, in some people cause medication overuse headache. So that the headache just sort of keeps coming back. You know, we know caffeine can do that. So I think that, you know, try to use things that are a little safer that aren't going to predispose to the medication overuse. You know, when there's anything that you usually think of as an acute drug, you know, we know that corticosteroids can help, you know, sort of get rid of a bad bout of migraine attacks, but you don't want to do that regularly because those have a whole host of side effects, potentially including adrenal failure or, you know, ulcers or poor skin healing or diabetes or cataracts or, you know, all these things. And so they're okay to do occasionally, but we really needed to find better medications to prevent and acutely treat migraine that don't have all those side effects.
So speaking of steroids, Hillary asked that she gets a short course of prednisone.
Prednisone.
Yeah. And it's the only thing that completely takes away her migraine. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to her that, you know, there must be an inflammatory aspect to migraine. Can you explain if there's any other way that she can treat migraine besides taking this treatment? Because
so it sounds like she's taking it acutely when she gets her headaches. So one thing I'd say one thing, a couple things that I can think of. One is, and I'm not talking about her specifically, I'm going to say for anyone that finds that it really works. I think, you know, some, there are a lot of people that steroids like prednisone don't really help them that much. Unfortunately, there are some people that it does. And a lot of times if they're having a really bad headache that they can't break, they'll try it. But I have known that there are a number of people where they work really well when, you know, we take the history better or the headaches morph a little bit, but they really are experiencing, you know, maybe more of a cluster type headache or a paroxysmal hemicrania or another headache type that really could be treated with another medication that might be safer and that would cut down on the need for taking the corticosteroids. When I had patients that needed those occasionally, I'd be very careful. I'd keep track in their chart and I didn't like to use them more than every few months. Just because of the fact that they can have bad side effects, but you don't want them to interfere with the adrenal function because that, you know, could be really very serious. So I would say to someone like that, you know, have they really tried everything? If they had tried everything that was available a few years ago, have they tried some of the things that are available now? Because with the Ditans and the Gepants, you know, new drugs out there, even an old drug like DHE is now FDA approved for inhalation or nasal spray therapy or whatever. That's supposed to be very effective and not have the side effects it had before. That, you know, to try some of those things for the acute attack or some of the neuromodulatory devices out there now. You know, there's one where it gives a sub-threshold painful stimulus on the arm, you know, an electrical stimulus that can stop acute headache. that's sort of newly on the market. So, you know, there's a vagal nerve stimulator type device externally that's on the market. Cefaly is now over the counter. So I think that there's a lot of things that if a person hadn't tried that, they might find that there are some things that work very well for them. If they just had tried the triptans and had tried all of them and said, well, they just didn't work for me, maybe theirs aren't going to work for her, but something else that has a different mechanism may be very effective. So.
Excellent. So it sounds like low-grade inflammation is actually behind a lot of modern-day diseases that we see. And the signs of this inflammation, this chronic low-grade inflammation, can be subtle. And sometimes they're expressed in conditions that we might be facing, or other times we just might be sort of, you know, a little bit sluggish, be a little bit fatigued, which, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of those signs and symptoms are part of migraine itself. So addressing this through dietary factors, lifestyle, stress management, and working with your clinician for treatment sounds like the solution that hopefully will come to a sustainable, a sustainable improvement.
Yeah, I think it really needs to be an integrated approach. I think you can't just sort of do one thing. I mean, if you can, that's great. But, you know, it's hard to argue against all the sort of lifestyle changes that are just what we really should recommend to every single person at length, you know, every visit, because those are the things that, they go to their primary care doctor for, to be aware of those things. And, they're a little bit harder and you have to sort of keep at them. But, medications have a role, sometimes a very important one. But if you can, not need the medications to start with, because, you know, every medication has a potential side effect, and you may not even be aware of what some of the side effects are. I'm not talking about even the migraine ones per se, but, you know, you think of all these proton pump inhibitors and, you know, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and all these things that people take that aren't just working on one part of the body. You know, they have a systemic effect, and, you know, as few drugs as a person can get away with taking, you know, the better it is.
So maybe a reasonable sort of philosophy might be to throw everything at once, like combine all the behavioral and lifestyle factors, you know, combine sort of the treatments that you're prescribed from the doctor, with the view of hopefully tapering off the treatments and continuing all the things that have all the positive side effects, like, you know, good sleep, movement, improved diet, etc.
Yeah. And, you know, we used to use a lot more because the drugs weren't as effective. You know, you wouldn't be on one, you'd be on two or three. I mean, I think just as in other conditions like epilepsy, where you try to get people on a monotherapy, you know, they may need to be on a medication, but if they're doing some of the other things that aren't medication related, but are still therapies for their headache, they may find that they can find an effective therapy, but they're not taking more than one, where you have to worry about all these drug-drug interactions. You know, once you're taking more than a few drugs, the chances that the drugs are going to be interacting with each other in a way that have potential side effects is, you know, gets increasingly high. So,
fantastic. Okay. Well, Dr. Tijan, this has been wonderful. I've taken some mental notes about changes that I can make to improve my own health and well-being and lower my sort of inflammation. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Migraine World Summit.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I hope your audience finds the things we talked about helpful for them.